Thank you very much, and it's good to see some familiar faces here at Westminster. Good to be back with you, as Sarah said, be giving you something of a Russia update, talking a little bit about my research over the past year, and we'll delve into a number of interesting questions, I think, for you over the month, including relations between Russia and Ukraine, and relations between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Russian government. So today I'll be giving some background to how we spent our year, but in the weeks ahead we'll delve into some of those more specific topics. Let's open with a word of prayer. Lord, we thank you for the gift of this new day, for the time that you give us together as Christian brothers and sisters. We remember Christian brothers and sisters in other parts of the world, the great communion of saints that is won through your Son, Jesus Christ. We pray for deeper understanding between the peoples of the world, for commitments to peace and your righteousness. Now grant us time to listen and learn and to seek to enter into another culture, another expression of Christian faith. We give you thanks for this time together in Jesus' name. Amen. This past year, so a year ago at this time, September 5th, my wife and I traveled from the United States back to Russia. We have been going back and forth to Russia for almost 15 years now, so it's hard to believe how we've developed so many contacts there over the years. And this was our third long stay in Russia. 15 years ago, we spent a year in St. Petersburg. 8 years ago, a year in Moscow. And this time, with the support of the Fulbright program, my wife and I spent a year out in the boonies, in Russia, what they call the provinces, because Russia is a country where there are really only two big cities and then the provinces. So the biggest city, of course, Moscow. After Moscow, St. Petersburg. But then there's quite a dramatic difference when you travel outside of those two big cities to smaller cities, to the towns and villages that constitute the majority of the Russian Federation. So there's often a saying in Russia that there's Moscow and there's Russia. And we weren't going to see Moscow this time. It's a little bit like the difference between, say, Manhattan and Peoria, Illinois. And we'd already done Manhattan, so now we were going to do Peoria, Illinois. And people sometimes say, well, why would you ever choose the equivalent of Peoria, Illinois? Well, but to get to know the United States, you can't just spend your time in New York City and Washington, D.C., right? So it's important to get out to the heart of the country. There we go. We were in a town called Belgorod, and it's on the map here. So Moscow is up there, and Belgorod is the red spot about 400 miles south of Moscow, about an 8-hour train ride. A town of 400,000, close to Ukraine, You can see there's Ukraine, so Belgorod's only about 25 miles from Ukraine, so we were very aware of the crisis between Russia and Ukraine as we lived from September to May in this town, Belgorod, which means the white city. The city that is white because there are chalk hills in that part of Russia. The white chalk gave the name to the city Belgorod. A town of about 400,000 in a province with 1.5 million people, primarily rural, agricultural, a fairly prosperous region of Russia. The standard of living is not bad. It's not equivalent to Moscow, but it's also not one of Russia's poorest regions. This is the Black Earth area of Russia that also extends into Ukraine, where the soil is very rich. Agriculture traditionally has been very successful. The breadbasket. There are even people from the north of Russia who like to retire in Belgorod because it's more to the south, even though it's still, I don't know, the equivalent in latitude, probably equivalent to Toronto, Canada. It's not very far south, but for Russia, it's a lot warmer than the Arctic Circle. So the town has benefited from it's not quite Florida, but it's at least south for Russia. And my particular project had to do with trying to understand how Christian believers sustained their faith in the late Soviet period. In the 1960s and 1970s, the 80s, until the time of Gorbachev. We remember Mikhail Gorbachev and Perestroika, Glasnost, the opening up of the Soviet Union that eventually led to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. But I was interested in the late Soviet period after Khrushchev. So from about 1964 on, and how believers under conditions of persecution and religious marginalization managed to hold on to their faith. And what obstacles did they face? What strategies did they develop? Where did religion die? Where did religion stay alive? Part of what's interesting about that late Soviet period is that after Khrushchev, after 1964, the concentration camps were pretty much closed. Believers were no longer being sent to the gulag. That was the situation in the 1920s and 30s and even early 1940s. But by the 60s and 70s, believers weren't being persecuted physically for their faith, but they were marginalized. They suffered discrimination. If you were a Christian believer, you couldn't have certain occupations. You couldn't work as a police officer. You couldn't work in government administration. If you're a Christian believer, your children most likely could not get permission to go to university and to receive a higher education. In the newspapers, in the magazines, there was active anti-religious propaganda. Religion was taunted, it was made fun of. People began to forget religion, especially as there was mass movement from the provinces to the big cities to find work. A younger generation of Russians began to feel more detached from church life. And so I was interested under those circumstances, not active physical persecution, but this kind of emotional, psychological persecution. How do people hold on to their faith? And are there lessons for us? Of course, our situation entirely different, where we don't live in a society that marginalizes religion in the same way that the Soviet Union did, and yet in every era, in every place, we know the challenges of holding on to Christian faith when the values of society sometimes correspond and sometimes don't correspond with the values that we hold as Christians. Or parts of society may be actively anti-religious, while other parts of society are more supportive. So are there lessons for us? And I guess the theme, the idea that I would like you to think about this morning, is maybe a little bit strange for us as Presbyterians, because we as Presbyterians, we put a lot of emphasis on knowledge and thinking and understanding. But the idea that I want you to think about this morning is the importance of ritual. The importance of religious ritual for sustaining Christian faith. Because this was certainly true for the Orthodox Church, that's the majority Christian church in Russia, that what helped to sustain Orthodox Christianity in those desert years of the 60s and 70s was the practice of Christian ritual. Now, what do I mean by ritual, the practice of ritual? Well, on the one hand, there were the rituals that all Christians share, things like baptism, the ritual of baptism, the ritual of having children baptized, the sacrament, receiving the sacrament of baptism, this promise of new life in Jesus Christ. The rituals of church worship, the sacrament of the Lord's Supper, the rituals of gathering for worship and celebration of what the Orthodox call the liturgy. But for Orthodox believers, other rituals, things like having icons, pictures, paintings of the saints, of Jesus, of the Virgin Mary with the child, the infant Jesus, having icons at home, praying with the help of those icons. That too was a basic ritual that helped to sustain Christian faith during the Soviet period, people who kept icons in their homes. So the power of ritual to help to sustain Christian faith under circumstances of persecution. And part of what made this interesting, this part of Russia interesting to observe, is precisely because it was away from Moscow and was a more rural agricultural area. Lots of smaller villages where people were, in a sense, on the margins of the Soviet Union. Not in its heart in Moscow. And we know that even in this country, there can be quite a bit of difference in religious practice, again, between, say, Manhattan and rural Alabama, right? I mean, religion can take many different expressions and forms, and this was true in the Soviet Union as well. All right, so that's the idea that we're going to think about this morning. We'll talk about a bit the power of ritual for helping to sustain Christian faith. But let me show you a few slides to give you a little bit of a sense of the place where we were living. So, again, Belgorod to the south of Russia, close to Ukraine, the Black Earth region. Here's a another map, a little bit of a close-up for getting you to practice your Cyrillic alphabet. But the arrow is pointing at Belgorod. So you can see how close it is to Ukraine, which is in the blue. And Before the crisis with Ukraine, many people would go back and forth between Russia and Ukraine on a weekly basis. They might live in Belgorod and work in Kharkov, large Ukrainian city that's only about 50 miles away. And there used to be a regular train service between the two cities. But now the border is much tighter. The lines for crossing the border can be very long. It's especially hard for young males to cross the border, Ukrainians who want to come to Russia, or young Russian men who want to go to Ukraine. A lot of harassment at the border. So the green is the province, this largely agricultural area, a lot of wheat production, raising of cattle, large chicken farms, swine, very prosperous agricultural area, but now mostly cut off from Ukraine. Here again, just another map to orient us a little bit. So here at the top is Belgorod, but if we were to, and to the left is Ukraine. But here you can see this little island called the Donbass. The Donbass, right there. And that is the disputed area between Russia and Ukraine. Still formally a part of Ukraine, but where there have been rebels, breakaway republics, pro-Russian activists, battles between Ukrainian and pro-Russian militia. So we were not right on the border with Donbass, but you can see not very far away. And we had students at the university and seminary where I was teaching. We had students from Donbass. There was regular bus service between Belgorod and the Donbass, so very much in our minds as we lived there for the year. Further south, there's Crimea, which, of course, Russia annexed against international law, but now regards Crimea as part of the Russian Federation. Well, the area in which we were living, Belgorod, was also the site of huge battles during World War II. And I don't know if there are any military buffs in the audience here, but the Battle of Kursk was one of the major battles between the Germans and the Russians in World War II. It was a huge tank battle, one of the hugest tank battles in history. Thousands and thousands of tanks involved on both sides. An incredibly destructive battle where the Russians successfully for quite a while defended their territory. In the end, the Nazis, the Germans, were able to occupy the territory, but it was a major loss of equipment and men, and a kind of one of those turning points in the war where it began to shift to the advantage of Russia and the Soviet Union. So there's a diorama in Belgorod, a museum where you are given an impression of what the battle was like. Very hard to imagine, to put into our reality. And today this is the memorial site that has been built not far from Belgorod, the memorial site to commemorate the Battle of Kursk. This is the town of Belgorod, where we lived. And you can see that much of the building is new, because during the war, 80% of the city was destroyed. So total rebuilding of the city, lots of new apartment buildings, a transformation of that part of Russia since World War II. I was based at the National University in Belgorod, which is especially strong in the sciences. Of course, my area was religion. There is also a religion department, a theology department, fairly small and modest. But we lived very close to this part of the campus. You can see that there's even a university chapel next to the university buildings. There's a pleasant stream, a small river that runs through the town, and this is where I would go jogging every morning, regardless of the weather. We also had good relations with the Orthodox Seminary in Belgorod, which is small, has maybe 100 students or so. This is the seminary church, the rector, and some of the professors, where we would sometimes attend services, because there is nothing like a Presbyterian church in Belgorod. So you're either Orthodox or you stay at home. The rector of the seminary, who became a good friend, the seminarians who are in the background there in the choir. So we spent quite a bit of time in this church over the course of the year. And then finally, just a couple of photos to whet your appetite for things to come later this month. But as I was investigating how believers held on to their faith in the late Soviet period, I discovered that there was a manifestation, a birth of a phenomenon called holy elders. This is very strange for Protestants and Presbyterians, but in the Orthodox tradition, and I think in Catholicism as well, there are saintly figures who can appear on the scene, who are regarded to be wise, to have spiritual experience, and people would make pilgrimage to these holy elders, and there they found a refuge, a place of Christian community. So I won't talk so much about that today, but in some weeks to come, I'll talk about one of these holy elders in particular, who lived in this village outside of Belgorod, a town called Rakitnaya, in this church. And this is a holy elder. Probably looks like your pastor, right? Wise, experienced, spiritual director, Seraphim Tyapochkin. These holy elders were incredibly important to people in the 1960s and 70s to find a refuge, a protected place, a place where they felt they could trust the religious authorities. They gathered around such people as Seraphim Tyapochkin. So this was very, very interesting to me. He's no longer living. He died in 1982, but they have preserved his cell, his icons, his legacy, and part of my research was to try to get to know more about him and to understand why he was so important to believers in this region of Russia during the 1960s and 1970s. This is a picture of some of the pilgrims, some of his spiritual family, the people who would travel from even Moscow or Belgorod, other cities, but they would travel out to the countryside to be in the presence of this holy man. So he's quite elderly at this point, as you can see, but these are his beloved spiritual children who found a sense of spiritual freedom and experienced his deep love for them. They would gather, some coming every week, to be in his presence. His grave continues to be a pilgrimage site. It's right next to the church. And I visited this church 4 or 5 times over the course of the year in Belgorod. This is the successor, the priest who now serves in that church and helps to preserve the legacy of Serafim Kalpochkin. Okay, well, those are the slides. So now let's turn for just a few minutes to try to understand what it was like to be a believer in the Soviet Union in the 1960s and 70s. And many of us grew up during that period. I was born in 1954, so I'm a child of the Cold War. I remember the way in which we pictured the Soviet Union as an existential threat. And of course, Russians felt the same way about us. What was it like to be a believer in those circumstances of the Cold War era, after World War II, after Khrushchev, who of course came to the United States and took his shoe off and pounded on the podium at the United Nations? And you know, Khrushchev was the one who said, during our lifetime, we will see the last priest in the Soviet Union. He was very anti-church, very anti-religious, very dedicated to eliminating religion, not through sending people to the gulags, but through this constant anti-religious propaganda and pressure. Well, Belgorod and the province around it were an interesting place to examine religious circumstances in the 1960s and 70s because of an interesting irony. When the Nazis invaded in 1941, one of their strategies for winning the support of the Russian population in the territory that they occupied, the Nazis began to allow the reopening of Christian churches. Now, Hitler was no friend of religion. Hitler himself would have destroyed the Christian churches if he could have, and might eventually have done so. But this was political calculation to try to show the Russian people that the Nazis were friendly and supportive. They allowed the Russian people to begin to reopen churches. This part of Russia was occupied by the Nazis for about 3 years, and many churches were reopened, so that by the end of the war in 1945, in this Belgorod province, there were 90 churches that had reopened in an area, as I say, of about 1.5 million people. 90 churches, and that's significant because at that time in Moscow, there were fewer than 20 churches. A city with millions of people, but this province on the margins of the Soviet Union had 90 churches that had reopened under the Germans. The Soviets, especially under Khrushchev, tried to close some of those churches again. There was a wave of church closings in the 1960s. But for the most part, the churches remained open, but with severe restrictions. Not only the social pressures that I've already described, but also with legal measures. So, for example, all religious activities had to be within the building of the church. All religious activities. A priest could not come to your home and pray with you. It was against the law. A priest could not go with you to the cemetery to bury your beloved one. It was against the law. There could be no public religious pilgrimages, no public religious gatherings, worship services. Everything had to be restrained, constrained, placed within the church building itself. In addition, the government was actively trying to restrict who came to church. So took measures to prevent especially children and teenagers from coming to church. Scheduled school activities on Sunday mornings. Or at the time of Easter, the largest, most extravagant celebration in the Orthodox Church. There would actually be policemen around the church buildings, not allowing children and young people into the church celebration of Easter. The church, the religious authorities were trying to discourage baptisms, and so required that priests get the permission of both parents before a child was baptized. Well, often the father had fallen, had died in World War II. There was no father to give permission. And so the government authorities would not allow the priest to perform a baptism. This constant pressure to push religion into the boundaries of the church building and even within the church building to restrict. Really, there could be no Sunday school. It was against the law. There was no social work. It was against the law. When I look at the bulletin of your activities at Westminster, 99% of what you do today would have been forbidden. There were people who would actually sit and listen to the sermons. In fact, preaching was discouraged. And there were informants who would sit in the churches and listen to what the pastors were preaching. And if the priests touched anything that seemed remotely political, they could be fired, they could be transferred. They could be sent to a village in Siberia. So, yes, it was very, very close monitoring. The only thing that was allowed was celebration of the liturgy. So, 2 hours on a Sunday morning.
What year did they start sending them to the gulags?
Did they stop?
Start.
In the 1920s, and there was a huge wave of persecution sending believers to the gulags. 1920s, 1930s.
They needed to persecute the Christians.
Communist ideology was anti-religious from the outset. Remember, maybe you've heard this, Karl Marx had the famous saying that religion is the opium of the people. It's like a drug. It promises people heaven, but there is no heaven. Our job as communists is to build the ideal society on earth right now. There is no God. It's up to us. And so as soon as the communists came to power in 1917, they began to persecute the church. It reached a kind of high point in the late 1930s. Today it's estimated that, how do you count the figures? People suffered for many different reasons during the Soviet era. But about 90% of priests and monks and nuns were sent to the gulag, arrested. The majority died. So severe, severe persecution. As I say, after the war, after the German reopening of churches, no longer that kind of active physical persecution, but still marginalization of the church.
Were there very many other non-Christians in Russia at the time?
In this part of Russia, it's very interesting. There were quite a few active Baptist groups. And that was because of the influence of Ukraine. Baptists were very active in Ukraine, and this is close to Ukraine. There were quite a few Baptist communities. The difference between the Orthodox and the Baptists was that the Baptists did not want to be officially registered with the government. There was a law at that point that all religious communities had to register and be approved by the government. And many of the Baptists felt that their theology was the Soviet government is satanic, it's demonic, we don't want anything to do with it. They would refuse to register, and that meant that they suffered even more harassment and persecution than the Orthodox. The Baptists, too, were seen as having connections to the West. Getting money, Bibles, support from Western groups, so that also made it more difficult for them.
Mm-hmm. And one more question. Sure.
About Judaism?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there were at one point, especially in this part of Russia, large Jewish communities, but much of that was eradicated by the Nazis. Those Jewish communities that survived were very small, and they were mostly left alone because they were seen as harmless.
But then when communism was taking over, they were told to quit worshiping as well.
Well, they were not actively persecuted in the same way because they were so small. They were so insignificant religiously. And also, this is an odd question, the question's not odd, the answer is odd, that In those days in the Soviet Union, everyone in their passport had their nationality registered. And Judaism was considered a nationality. So your passport might say, citizen of the Soviet Union, Ukrainian. Citizen of the Soviet Union, Russian. Citizen of the Soviet Union, Jewish. Because Judaism was seen not simply as a religion, but also as an ethnic, national category. And many of the Bolsheviks, many of the communists, had in their passports Jewish. They weren't practicing Jews, but ethnically they had Jewish roots. And so officially they were classified as Jewish. So the Jewish question is very interesting, but more complicated in some ways. But the actual practice of Judaism, very, very small and seen as largely harmless compared to the Orthodox. So these severe, severe restrictions. Yeah?
You mentioned the theological seminary.
Yes.
My recollection is that there were seven seminaries, and at a certain point in time, they were restricted to two.
Yes.
I think the one in Sikorsk and the one in Leningrad. And then afterward, and I can't remember the events, but afterward, they expanded to, back to the seven. So I'm curious if this was part of the seven that you mentioned, or if this was an additional one, and when it was allowed to be founded.
Great. Okay, great question. What about seminary education? So when the persecution reached its height in the late 1930s, every seminary was closed. No seminary was functioning in the Soviet Union. After World War II, when there was a little bit of relaxation, the seminary in Zagorsk, north of Moscow, was reopened. Then the seminary in Leningrad, so you're quite right, and eventually a third seminary in Odessa. Those were the three that functioned until the late Soviet period. This seminary in Belgorod was founded after the fall of the Soviet Union, so in the 1990s.
So how many Orthodox seminaries are there now in the former Soviet Union?
There would be about 50 to 60 different seminaries now. Yeah. But you're quite right. For a long time, there were two or three, Leningrad, Moscow, and Odessa. So that's another element to the restriction of religion in the 1960s and 70s. The government highly restricted who could go to seminary. Usually the only people who could get permission to go to seminary were sons of priests. But anybody else who felt a calling to religious service was discouraged, forbidden. And the priests who did serve were vetted by the KGB to ensure that they were politically loyal. So terrible, terrible circumstances under which the church had to try to do its work. And now back to my thesis for this morning, that what helped to sustain the church during that time was ritual, was habit, it was tradition. So let's take the example of baptism. Many, many Russians and Ukrainians, because of the weight of tradition, felt we have to baptize our children. Now, they couldn't have told you why. They couldn't have explained the theology of baptism. The priest didn't explain what it meant. But my mom was baptized. My dad had been baptized. My grandparents had been baptized. If you're a Russian, if you're a Ukrainian, you baptize your children. You just do it. Now, you know, I have kind of an ambivalent feeling about that. Is that really Christian baptism when you do it just out of habit? If you're not able to say what it means, but somehow it meant something to people. They couldn't explain what it meant. They couldn't give you words for it. They couldn't give you a theological treatise. But it's important to baptize my baby. If I'm a Russian, I baptize my children. And interestingly, this was true even of many government officials. They would secretly, quietly, have their own children baptized. Officially, they were atheists. Officially, they were members of the Communist Party. But there was something about the weight of ritual, habit, tradition. If you you have an infant, it has to be baptized. Another example would be burial, funerals. Now, the communists did make somewhat greater inroads on the question of a church funeral. They were less successful with church baptisms, a little bit more successful in eliminating church funerals, but still, even in the late Soviet period, about 50% of the people in this Belgorod region wanted their beloved ones to be buried by the church. There was something about a church funeral, about going through the ritual, the prayers, the words, the incense, the garments of the priest, the liturgy, the richness of the ritual that continued to compel people to have their loved ones have a church funeral. Baptism, funerals, keeping icons at home, having a prayer corner. It wasn't something that you advertised. We met women, elderly women in villages in Russia who, during the Soviet period, had a curtain that they could draw in front of the icon on the wall so that if anybody walked in, it wasn't obvious. But there was something about having that picture of Christ or Mary or Saint Nicholas or one of the other great saints of the Russian tradition. There was something about having that picture, that painting, that icon on your wall that, again, people couldn't have explained exactly why. They couldn't have given you a theology of a prayer. They couldn't have explained the meaning of the Trinity or why Jesus is Savior of the world, but there was something about keeping that connection. So this was the situation in the 60s and 70s. This is what kept the embers of religion still smoldering, a few sparks, a few embers, a few coals, because of the weight of tradition. Now, my question to us is, well, what do we make of that? Is that good? Is that odd? Is that a legitimate way of being Christian? Is that just empty ritual, meaningless? We're Presbyterians, shouldn't we be able to explain why we do the things that we do? Before your baby is baptized at Westminster, aren't you supposed to talk to the pastor about what baptism means? Aren't we supposed to look at the Book of Order and there will tell us in the directory for worship how to perform a baptism and why we do it, or a church funeral, or how to pray. So I'm interested in your reaction, what this does to religion for better or worse when it's reduced to a few basic rituals. Of course, maybe the interesting question is why the communist authorities even allowed that much, instead of forbidding everything. But I'm curious what you make of the power of ritual.
How do you separate the ritual, the spirituality, from the superstition?
Great question. How do you separate the spirituality of baptism from the superstition? So were people just doing it out of superstition? Wonderful question. I don't think, how would we ever know? It's a tough question. I need to do this. Well, why do you need to do it? By the way, this happens in American society today, doesn't it? There are people who want their babies baptized, and, well, why? You don't go to church? Well, I want the baby baptized. Well, but do you believe in God? Well, you know, sort of. Well, grandma thinks it'd be a great idea to baptize the baby. What do we do with that, you know? Is that, yeah, it's a great, great question. Where does this become meaningless or superstitious? Where does it help to sustain Christian faith?
So I'm intrigued by that question, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how you define superstition as separate from faith. I mean, just viscerally, I want to say that those are two different things. My own guess would be that superstition is when you try to explain things that you observe through supernatural means, and just say, you know, this is what explains natural phenomena. This is why, this is why the planet spins. This is, you know, it's almost like trying to use superstition is sort of a substitute for science, whereas faith is it is about explaining something that is unexplainable.
Well, you know, these are, I ponder this a lot. So, for example, I had a situation a number of years ago with one of my daughters, and she was in an automobile accident, and I had a lot of fear about what was going to happen to her, how she would survive it. She would survive it physically, but just what the emotional damage was going to be and so on. And like many Christians, what did I do? I prayed. I said, God, bring about healing. God, I have a need here. I'm turning to you. I need help. Well, is that superstition or is that faith? Am I hoping for a supernatural intervention that defies the laws of science, or am I doing what Christians ought to do? Of course, knowing in the end that it's in the hands of God. God doesn't listen just to what I say. But, yeah, for me, it's gotten very complicated trying to sort out superstition, faith. I mean, yeah, you know, when I see people in Russia stand, they never go to church, they don't, couldn't tell you what they believe, but they light a candle in front of an icon and hope that that will take their problems away. I scratch my head. That looks to me like superstition. But then, from an atheistic communist point of view, all prayer must look like superstition. So where do we draw the line?
It seems to me, looking across the epistles and what Paul had to say about this, there's a lot, particularly when he's fighting the Jews about circumcision and things like that, and what foods were permitted to which weren't. It seems to me that Paul makes the distinction between what gets in the way of faith and what is maybe not relevant but not harmful here.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that some of that may fall into that latter category.
That's helpful, I think, isn't it? Yeah, that what helps to deepen trust in Christ? What helps to deepen a sense of communion with God? If something becomes my effort to manipulate God, well, maybe that's shading towards superstition. But if I baptize, maybe I can't explain why I'm baptizing my child, but there's this sense that I'm entrusting this child. I'm entrusting myself into the hands of God. Well, maybe something is right about that. But that's a good question, good observation. Yes?
Well, along that line, there's sort of an added assurance
there's any question.
Right, right. You know, is this just a little bit of spiritual insurance, or is it going to lead to continuing deep relationship with God? Yes?
I wonder if that is, you know, the covering all bases, or covering, is it some subconsciousness of the acceptance and connection with, you know, the divine mystery?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you've put your finger on, that's what I ponder, you know. It's like just covering all the bases, or is there some sense that there's something, I can't explain what it is. I don't know, maybe, you know, I'm just being crazy, but I have this sense that there's something deeper, something powerful, something that matters. I'm not, you know, maybe a person is not a very faithful churchgoer, maybe they're not a very profound theologian, but still that sense that my life is incomplete without something of this connection. And so that's why over the years I've come to be a little bit more patient with the power of ritual and not just to dismiss it. Yeah. John. It's actually in an old liturgical language called Slavonic, but it's related to Russian.
How much do we understand?
There's another. The average villager in 1960 understood very little, unless they had been raised by their parents or grandparents to understand some of the language. So some of the prayers they understood. I mean, there's a line in the liturgy that repeats itself, Lord have mercy, Gospodi pomiluj. Yeah. Things like that they understood, of course.
I guess the point is that it can't be nonsense.
They
have to understand something.
Right.
What they're doing.
Something. They understood something. Yeah, yeah. Again, the tradition carried some of this. So, you know, they understood what the basic holidays, what they were about, Christmas or Easter. They understood that the church sacraments had something to do with communion with Christ. But did they understand the hymns? Probably not. There are long hymns in the Orthodox liturgy, traditional hymns that are in Church Slavonic that they probably, you know, they just listened to. They just heard the music, but didn't understand any of the words. Yeah. Okay, how's our time here? Well, we're about at our time limit, right? So, I leave you with that thought. I think you have made really, really interesting observations about ritual, where maybe it's powerful, where maybe it's empty. But just to say, again, in the 1960s and 70s, this was all that was left. And this is what kept the church, even in a very restricted, limited form, this is what kept the church alive. And therefore, I want to understand better that kind of deep connection that people sometimes feel around these rituals. Next week, then, I'd like to turn to talk a little bit more about Russia and Ukraine, the situation in that part of Russia where we were living, what's developing politically, and I look forward to seeing you then. Thank you for coming today.